show didn't stand up.
Yeah.
Fucking late show represent.
One girl in the front row stood up by herself.
Yes, that's right.
It was so sweet. And then she turned around and saw that no one else was standing up, and she sat down.
It was the best.
I felt it.
It was the best, strongest ovation from the loneliest person. It's my greatest fear to stand up in front of people who I assume are standing and actually are sitting and staring at my ass. That's probably in the top three.
Uh-huh. What are the other ones?
Of course, Moths in a Box and just everything that's happening today. But other than that... We're all together. That's what's important, aren't we? Yes.
We are.
Yes.
Oh, the late show.
Yes, late show vibes.
As we were walking up the stairs, Vince is walking us to the stage and he goes, now remember, they've been drinking since 5.
Yes. That's right.
So have we.
I mean, look. I couldn't stay on the wagon for too long. 17 years is quite some time.
Stop shaking me.
That's one of our best new bits. Let's see.
Talked about that.
Yeah, we did that already.
That guy.
Oh, some of you may have been here, but the first show... At the end of the show, we had a wedding proposal of marriage.
A wedding proposal of marriage.
Yeah, it wasn't just any wedding proposal, it was of marriage.
Of marriage one.
And not only that, if you follow the My Favorite Murder Out of Context Twitter feed, it's the people that run that. Mm-hmm. It's that couple, we brought them up. Said, thanks so much for doing that. They told us the story behind it. So cute. They dated in high school. Then they broke up and led their lives. Then they met again.
And I was like, I wonder which one's going to propose. And then she was shaking so much, I realized it was her.
It was like,
Ange was going to do it. I was like, you don't shake that much and not know what's about to fucking happen.
And then she said... Since I'm broke and pulled a ring pop out of her pocket.
It was so cute. It was so. I almost gave her my one of mine, but it's probably cost less than the ring pop did. That's not insulting to Vince because we went and bought it together.
Oh, it's not.
not the good one. The one that I was like, I guess I need a wedding ring after we got married.
Everything about that gesture sucks.
I know. It didn't mean it that way. But there it is.
But there it was.
But there it was. Laying on the floor with the rug that we brought from home.
Oh, this is My Favorite Murder,
That's
by the
right.
way. It's a podcast.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That's Karen Kilgariff.
This is Georgia Hardstark.
Stop shaking
Stop
me.
Stop shaking me.
This is so dumb. We were in New York all week. We saw one...
Excuse me, yes.
Completely naked man in front of our hotel yesterday.
Just one. Just the one.
Thankfully, just one sighting.
Thankfully, it was only him.
And that's good luck, I think, when you see one.
In L.A., it's if you see Angeline, that lady in the pink car, that's good luck.
Right.
And then in New York, just a fully nude man at night on the sidewalk.
In front of the door to your hotel that you're about to have to walk through.
Good luck!
Good luck, goodbye.
Yes.
That happened.
That really happened to us.
And I flashed you. If you were here for the show before this, you'll know that I walked out of the elevator knowing Karen was going to be waiting for me so I could give her her bag. And at that moment, I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I don't have sleeves on my dress. Pulled it down so my tits were out and just walked out of the elevator.
At what was it? Midnight on a Saturday.
Today's Saturday.
On a Friday night.
Right.
Midnight, Friday night, New York City hotel. And Georgia rolls the fucking dice and comes out topless. Anyone could have been standing next to me.
Either way, it's a great story.
No, I mean, could have even been a better story
That's
if there was
true.
Just a Just a group of businessmen standing stand there talking about the fucking Dow Jones Industrial Average. And then, whoa.
And then, but I was like, bet on, you know, red. And then I was right. And then you also, can you bet on red in the Dow Jones
Probably,
Industrial?
Yes. I think it's green and purple and pink and red.
Oh.
And then you just bet. And then you make friends. For me, visually, it was shocking, not because Georgia was topless, because she's done that fun trick to me several times.
It's true. Surprise nakedness, I highly recommend it as a joke.
Also, she makes her eyes go like 3 times wider than I've ever seen them, so there's lots to look at. It's like, what's this? How are you doing that? What's happening? it's the embodiment of surprise. Mm-hmm. But also that little dress you have, it's like a sundress with an elastic at the top. And she just had it right underneath her tits. So it's kind of like how you do an off the shoulder if you have your choice. You're like, I don't know, I'll go off the shoulder. She's just like, I'm gonna go down here today. I'm just gonna make it like
surprise, I'm naked.
Sometimes we have to make our own fun.
It's my bit.
We do have to do hallway bits.
That's right.
It's good.
Steven's not here.
Steven's not here, everybody.
I know. He's taking care of my cats. That's how... What?
You go, he's taking care of my cats.
No. Oh!
Stop it!
Stop shaking me! he's doing a great job. Lots of photos.
Yes, he always does such a good... He dedicates himself to the taking care of your cats.
I think he's figured out... he got a new app or something, because now he's got a photo of them, and then it... and then hearts appear around it.
Yes.
And like a little song comes on if I hit the loud thing on, which I never do.
I thought you were going to say that he had cat ears and like a cat face on the cats.
That would be cute.
It's cat face app for cats. You love cats so much.
Put an extra cat face
on your cat's face.
It'll be great. Yeah.
Is that the end of that anecdote?
That's the one.
That really wasn't anything.
It wasn't.
Guys, it's, show.
It's late.
You don't get the strongest anecdotes, but...
That guy has an I'm an Elvis shirt on. You have an I'm an Elvis shirt on, don't you? And a Mimi! I have a Mimi shirt! Oh my God!
She did the brave thing and stood right up.
She has lotion on her hands, by the way, and it feels really good. That's why I'm touching her so much.
Also, because we're working on our new Cirque du Soleil act, where we just weirdly pull each other to the side as the opening of the show.
We just did a show, and then we do the meet and greet after with 100 people. It's lots of hugging and smiling, and it's really lovely. And then both of us go back. We're not old ladies, and yet both of us go back into the green room and just do these stretches. Because like, both of our back hurts really. My hips this time.
My plantar fasciitis.
Have you tried this hip thing? It's real sad.
There's a lot of grunting and groaning. And it's not like this is sports.
Strenuous.
Or anything
at all. Hard.
There's 5 minutes of standing and then there's an hour of sitting. And we're like, how do we get through another night?
No one's ever thrown their back out from hugging people before. And yet.
We had a girl in the meet and greet who said... She went really fast. She was like, great to meet you. And she was walking away and she goes, my psychic Italian grandmother knows who killed JonBenet as she walked away. Yep. Yes.
And Karen's like, what?
Get fucking back here right now.
And she goes, Karen goes, she's psychic? And she goes, she's a psychic nutritionist. And then fucking left.
And they walked away.
A psychic nutritionist, I can tell you, ate fucking whatever for breakfast.
Right. She's like, stop with the carbs already. And she's like, you don't have to be a psychic. You really. That's a bit of a scam, psychic nutritionist.
That's true.
I don't know. It feels like you're eating a ton of carbs. I don't know why.
I feel like you eat chocolate and cry in hotel beds.
I don't know. It seems like you lay down all the time, Aaron.
I feel like you ate McDonald's in a New York hotel room.
And you're like, oh no, sorry, I just burped. I'm so sorry. That was me. You're not psychic. I'm repeating.
Should we sit down?
Yes. Tonight's table was brought to you in miniature.
No, we haven't grown in size. The table has shrunk. This is a magic show.
It is.
I wonder if they used this when they were here for the recent Price is Right Live. Did you guys know that was a fucking thing? I mean, I know the Price is Right is live to begin with.
Right, live to tape.
Yeah, I've been. It's so much fucking fun, and I hate everything. And it was like, Drew Carey was amazing and a dream. It was lovely.
And did you didn't get to run on down.
Fuck no. You have to be like fun and excited. You have to be like, it's 6 in the fucking morning and they interview and you have to be like, I'm a dancing, you know, a poet for my job.
Right,
and
exactly.
I'm so excited to be here. And I'm just not.
What would your, say, I'll be the announcer, probably Don Pardo. I can't remember who it is. And then you do, the camera's going to go like this. Yeah. And then, well, the next contestant on The Price is Right, come on down, Georgia Hartstark.
Sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. No, it should be you. You should go. Go for me.
I'm the director. Cut.
Go again.
We're going to take that again with
someone else.
Okay, now you do it and I'll do my reaction.
And the next contestant on The Price is Right is Karen Kilgariff. Come on down.
I would straight up deny.
Yeah.
I would never be there in the first place.
This is a late show.
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
This is also a true crime comedy podcast, before we get started. Thank you.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know.
We always like to run that down for people.
Yeah, some people don't know.
It's true crime. There's people who are brought to this show by other people against their will and against their better judgment.
Someone in the meet and greet line, they were like three people who were like so happy and hugging us. And there's one woman who's just like, I guess. And the girl goes, this is my aunt. She thought she was coming to a murder mystery show.
She thought we were going to solve the murders at the end of the show.
How did they lie to her?
And I was kind of looking at her. I was like, sorry. And she was like, can't win them all.
I mean, it kind of is. It's like a mystery how this is happening.
We had a girl in the, this is my... my favorite moment is happening in my brain. The meet and greet in New York. There was a girl who was we call them drag-alongs. She was a drag-along.
We've never called them that before, but I love it.
You know, drag-alongs, that thing we say all the time and have t-shirts of. So the drag-along was like, it was that thing where she was like, I brought her, it's my birthday or whatever. And I turned to her and I was like, did you have fun? She was like, it was all right. It's like, all right, well, okay. And then she starts explaining how this friend of hers is so obsessed that every time they get into the car, she makes them listen to the podcast. And she goes, and I'm like sitting in the car like, why do we gotta listen to talking? And she's fucking right. She's right. Don't make your friends listen to talking. You're supposed to do it with your friend. And then when they're not there, do it with your other friends. But
are you first this time?
Are you ready to listen to some talking? Good. Good.
Good. You're first this time. I was first last time.
Oh, I didn't do the full explanation. So yes. If you're here and you've never seen this show before, it's a true crime comedy podcast, which is kind of a difficult combination sometimes. If people aren't used to this setup... You know, murder is obviously a terrible thing. It's very dark and it's very tragic. Mm-hmm. And we're not laughing at the fact that people kill other people. There's nothing funny about it. But in the way that we have the conversation about it, because of our personalities and the way we talk to each other, we are funny to each other about the things we're talking about. It's a complex, kind of a layered experience.
We say this at the top of every episode. You guys know this by heart by now.
Yeah, but just for the people who don't know... If you don't like it, get the fuck out, is essentially... That's all I'm saying. That's all. And now I'm going to do The Legend of Lizzie Borden.
supposed to follow that?
We'll do it fast.
Let me go first. I only have one photo. We can see it at the end. I can't follow that.
You do, what if Let it's a piece first. Of shit?
It's not. No, no. I don't want to change the rules.
No, don't change it. Okay. That's weird.
All right, Steven comes out. I'm sorry.
Steven comes out with a clipboard and a whistle. No, you cannot change it. You've been very inaccurate about the order for years. Please don't change it.
Okay. You go.
Yeah, I'm going.
Go. You're right.
I'm going to. Lizzie Andrew Borden.
That's not true.
Was born on July 19th, 1860 in Fall River, Massachusetts. Fall River? Is it pronounced Fall River?
River. I think it's Fall River.
When that one came up, I was like, I fucking got this. First fall and then river. There's no extra E-H's at the end or anything. So their father was grew up kind of poor, modestly, but he worked very hard throughout his life. Eventually becomes, he's the director of textile mills. He's a commercial landlord. He does very well for himself. At the time of his death, he was worth $300,000, which today is worth how much?
More than $300,000.
That's right. Over $8 million. What? So.
Shit, money bags.
The Bordens were rich bitches up on the hill.
Fuck.
Yeah. But Andrew, the father, I'm going to call him Andy, was a cheap bastard. He, even though families of means of the day all had electricity and indoor plumbing.
Basics.
Right.
As we call them.
Andy was like, we don't need that. We can go with that. Yes.
No, you can't. Try it once and then you're like, yeah, we need this. Flush the toilet one time in your life and you're like, wow.
They're all, wow, this is incredible.
I can't go without this.
Poor Lizzie's out in the outhouse with a candle. I really hate my life. She has an older sister named Emma and they're raised very religious, and Lizzie belongs to lots of fun clubs like the Endeavor Society of Women's Christian Temperance Union.
What?
They fucking do not party at all. That's the whole no. point of it.
They don't spike that holy water.
No.
Ever.
No.
Is that a thing?
No. Spiking holy water?
Yeah, it should be.
Well, you just go like this with it, so unless okay. you spike it with fucking acid. Then you're like, oh my God, Jesus is my boyfriend. I love him so much. You're gonna go see Dave Matthews with my boyfriend, Jesus. Finally! So, no.
Okay.
When she's 3 years old, Lizzie and Emma's mom dies. Or I should say just Lizzie's mom knows. Yeah, that's sad. Her father remarries a woman named nope. Abby Frey. Lizzie and her sister never call Abby mom or mother. They call her Mrs. Borden.
Oof.
Because they hate her fucking guts.
Even at 3 years old, or I guess older.
Well, as they grew up.
Yeah.
Once they learned how to give shade, they were like, oh, I know how to be very lightly rude to you all day, every day for the rest of your life.
Wow.
We're going to keep it formal. They both believe that Abby only married their father for his money. Mm-hmm. So they're not into it. Okay. So we're going to cut to, it's the end of July, 1892.
Okay.
Lizzie is an unmarried 32-year-old Sunday school teacher who, don't forget, belongs to the Women's Christian Union Temperance Union.
Right. Those crazy ladies. So, why marry when you got your bitches to chill with? Who fucking cares?
Oh, can we pull up the first picture? I'm not sure. Oh, yeah. So here's their home.
Home.
Millionaires.
It's very boxy.
And then on the left, there's the outhouse. It's just a huge, one huge pit on the other side of that door.
Cool. Okay. Looks bleak.
Oh, and then I think, would you go to the next picture too? Because I think we've got, there she is. There's our star.
She 100% looks like a character that a hilarious chick from Saturday Night Live would play. You know.
Yep, I do.
What's her name?
Yes, Kate McKinnon.
Thank you.
Yes. You know why? Because Kate McKinnon's, when she's being super funny, she just does crazy eyes like that.
Yeah.
But Lizzie had them all the time, apparently.
Look at those close-cropped curl bangs that she's... Is that a thing?
Those took some work.
Do I need to do that now?
Yeah, you should do a part straight up the middle. Every time we do old stories and I see the women's hairstyles from like long ago, it makes me panic. Like I have to have that hair right now. Because that shit where you have to wrap braids up around your head like fucking Heidi and walk around. I mean, I would have... It's horrifying to think. Just... What about the ones like the Jane Austen time where you had to do braid hoops? Like they're like big Mary J. Blige earrings, but braids? Who pulls that off?
Nobody.
Not this Irish face.
Instagram models.
What if the Jane Austen look came back?
Then the Instagram models can have it.
That's right. And they can keep it.
And then give it.
I do like a nice high collar, though.
High, tight bodice?
Just right up to...
To choke you.
Just right up to the chin. It's hot.
Okay.
Sometimes nudity is hot, and then sometimes covering your entire body is also hot. Just trying to wear a unitard dress.
It's all that will do.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So Lizzie is living in her father's house... As a Sunday school teacher, 32 years old, unmarried.
Nothing wrong with it.
No. But back then they called her a haggard spinster.
Oh, did they?
No, that's just, I just call her that. Okay. Okay, you can take that picture down of Lizzie.
It's scaring us.
It's a bit haunting.
It's a bit intense.
She's like, the entire time.
It's intense.
People in the audience are like,
got she's my
looking,
eyes.
Yeah, she's looking right at me. Okay.
Okay.
So a couple weeks before the time I'm about to talk about.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I don't know how I phrase that on the page. Lizzie and her sister get into a fight with their parents, their dad and stepmom, because they find out that the dad is giving huge amounts of real estate to Abby's family.
Don't do that.
So they're pissed.
Okay.
Okay, so then a couple days after this big family fight, the whole household is taken violently ill.
Uh-oh.
And, including their Irish maid, Maggie Sullivan. And so... Abby fears that somebody may have tried to poison them because she knows that no one likes her husband, including his daughters, and probably their Irish maid, most likely.
Sounds great.
Right?
Sounds like a healthy, fun place to hang out.
It's a fun house with no electricity or toilets.
Or alcohol.
And fighting, stress. Yeah, no fucking alcohol. I'm sure tons of Bibles. Okay, so everybody recovers, and they recover just in time for their Uncle John Morse to visit. And they think he was there to discuss the property transfer issue. Okay, so it's August 4th, 1892.
Okay.
So that morning, after breakfast, Andrew and Uncle John, they're in the sitting room, and John decides he's going to go head into town and buy a pair of oxen. He's just like, I'll be right back. I have to go pick up a couple oxen. I forgot.
I'm going to go to the bodega real quick.
And just grab two huge oxen and bring them back.
Anyone want any chobani in there?
Any Tate's cookies?
Yeah.
Ogre, just the oxen. Okay.
Okay.
He's also going to go visit another niece in Fall River. So he says he's going to be back at noon. And Andrew goes for a morning walk. This is around 9 a.m. Lizzie and Emma are supposed to clean John's guest room. Because that's one of their chores. They have chores, even though they're 32 and 34.
And have so much fucking money.
They have a ton of money no one will actually let them touch. And they have to pee in a field. still, go make the bed. So Emma's gone away to visit friends, and Lizzie's not anywhere to be found, so Abby goes up to clean that guest room sometime between 9 and 10:30 a.m., And as she's changing the pillowcases, she is struck on the side of the head just above the ear with a hatchet, causing her to fall face down on the ground. And then she's struck with that hatchet 18 more times on the back of the head.
Oh.
Killing her, no, it says at the end of the sentence. Turns out it killed her.
Was it the 17th?
It's,
it was the 17th.
Somewhere around 12 is what I heard.
Shit, but man.
It's all theory.
That is what we here at Law & Order call overkill.
That's right. There's a personal issue here. There's a rage issue here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but they don't know any of that yet because this is before police work was invented. Okay. Andrew gets back from his walk, but the front, he goes to open the front door with his front door key. It won't work, so he knocks. The Irish maid, Maggie, comes down. She tries to unlock the door. She finds that it's jammed. And then she claims that she heard Lizzie laughing on the stairs. But she looks around and she doesn't see her there.
Hey.
Where's page 3? There it is. Fuck. Why is page 3 after page 4?
Steven!
He has nothing to do
None.
With it.
It's actually probably Vince's fault.
No. Okay, so according to Lizzie, she had been out in the barn looking for, as we all do, you know, during the day when you're a lady walking around, looking for a piece of iron.
Okay. I feel like that got lost in translation of the past 100 years
right.
or so. Like, it made sense then?
Yes. At the time, she said something specific that made sense and was, people yeah. were like, oh, good, good, good.
Right.
But now it's just like,
what?
She was out touching pitchforks. Like,
like, looking for a piece of iron back then was like an innuendo for like, it was changing my, you know.
Say it.
Tampon.
Yeah.
Did they have that? They didn't have those.
No.
It was changing the cumbersome fucking diaper I had to wear when I got my period, essentially.
I was out in the red tent.
Yeah.
Okay, so she's out looking for iron.
Oh,
you know,
actually.
Your morning ritual. You, I'm can't wake up without my iron. So when she comes back into the house, she tells her father that Abby, the stepmother, had gotten a note from a sick friend, and so she'd left the house to go call on that friend. And then she helps her father. This is what she tells police later, that she brings her father over to the couch and helps him pull off his boots and get settled on the couch because he's going to take a nap. Okay, so then she tells Maggie that there's a sale at the department store, and why doesn't she go check it out? And Maggie, who probably makes 11 cents a week, is like, why don't you go fuck yourself, actually? Because I have to go scrub shit.
In an Irish accent, please.
Why don't you go fuck yourself?
Thank you.
Something like that?
Thank you, thank you.
Jesus! Lizzie Barden telling me to go shopping. Grandma? My grandma!
Grandma came.
I was just possessed by my psychic grandma. Okay. Maggie's like, I actually still don't feel bad from when we all got poisoned last week, so I'm going to go take a nap. And she goes up to her third floor, looked like an attic room, and she goes and takes a nap. So she's resting, and she then hears Lizzie screaming from downstairs, Maggie, come quick, father's dead, somebody came in and killed him.
Mm.
Yeah?
Mm.
Yeah. You say it all like that at once when something like that happens.
Let me hear it. Yell it.
Maggie, come quick, the father's dead. It's, you know, somebody came at the front door, it was jammed earlier, but then we got it open, remember that? We were sick last week, we weren't poisoned though, but we were all sick, remember? Anyway, somebody came in, a stranger, not from Fall River, probably from another town. Come quick, my father died. Thank you. You know there's a movie of this coming out. There's a movie coming out with Chloe Sevigny, I believe.
Ooh, I love her.
It looks good.
She can be creepy.
Yes, she can.
When she wants to be.
She can do that stare.
Fuck yeah, she can. Oh, yeah. It's already out.
Is it out?
There's a theater critic here.
We have to leave this show and go watch it.
Immediately.
Okay. So, Maggie comes down, she finds Andrew is slumped on the couch, and he has 11 hatchet wounds to the face. into his face.
Right in the old face. Huh?
11. That's 10 in a row, and then one for good measure.
Shit.
Ouch.
That's some anger.
I'm not going to put up the picture. If you are a Georgia, then you're going to look the picture up after the show.
It's horrifying. I was thinking about how I need to study that photo.
It's not good, but here's what's interesting. It looks like a man laying on a couch and who's tried to be funny and just put a bunch of hamburger on his face. That's essentially what it looks like. Well, I'm not showing it to you, so you can't be mad. I'm just painting a picture with words, and that's what I do for a living. Okay. Now, here's what's interesting. When you look at that picture, that crime scene photo, you will see that Andrew Borden has his boots on.
Ooh.
So there's things aren't adding up.
Get your story straight, Lizzie.
Yeah.
That's really your name.
Don't... Lizzie Andrew. Lizzie Andrew, get in here and get that story straight. Okay, so there's details.
Uh-oh.
His nose was cut off entirely.
Oh, you'd think so with 11 hits.
Yeah, yeah.
Shit.
So obviously there was even more screaming after the fact. And then Maggie runs to get a doctor, sadly and ironically. Now, the neighbors, who, of course, have heard intense blood-curdling screams, begin to gather at the house, which is what everybody used to love to do at crime scenes back in the day. Just come in, start walking around. Mm-hmm. So Lizzie goes out, and she starts telling all of them that Abby was out sick, visiting a sick friend. She basically
she
starts
talking
explaining
again.
Shit to everybody as her father is laying on the couch dead. She also mentions how the family had been poisoned the week before, or that she thought their milk was poisoned, how they'd all gotten sick at the same time. So the police, Maggie finally brings the police back, and they immediately suspect Lizzie. And this is a thing that has happened a lot. She's not acting like a daughter whose father has just been murdered with a hatchet. She's very calm and cold and poised. But maybe she was like that all the time. The other problem is that her story changes with every police person that she talks to. So first she says she was walking into the house, and then she heard a noise. But then the next person she talks to, she says she came in, she didn't hear anything, and everything was normal until she found her father. When she's asked where Abby is, she tells the police that she's gone to visit the sick friend. But then the next time she's asked, she changes her story and she says, "Oh, I think she's actually upstairs. Somebody go look?"
Yeah, they're like, can you finally go find her? I'm sick of putting on this charade.
Yes. So somebody else, could you go look for the person I know for a fact is alive upstairs? So Maggie and a neighbor lady start to walk upstairs, and they get like halfway up the stairs, and when they get eye level with the ground, they can see into the guest room, and they see Abby laying dead in a pool of blood. So there was probably more screaming there. Now, what's weird is even though they suspect her, the police do not check Lizzie's clothes or hands for blood, and she tells them that she needs to go lay down, so they can't really, they can only kind of glance into her room. She won't let them into her room at all to look around. Mm-hmm. And they're like, all right. I guess that's just how it is. So they do search the rest of the house, and in the basement they find two hatchets, two axes, and then a third hatchet head with a broken handle. They think the broken one might be the murder weapon because it looks like someone tried to add dust and dirt to the blade. So to try to kind of cover it up. Mm-hmm. But still, they take nothing from the house. There's no evidence. They're just like, okay, I'm going to take a picture with my mind. Got it. Dirty hatchet. All right. See you guys later. At one point, one of the officers sees Lizzie and her friend Alice Russell, who lives in the neighborhood, go into the cellar together. And they both leave the cellar, but then Lizzie goes into the house by herself, and he thinks he sees her washing something. She's like bent over the sink, washing something. He doesn't ask. He doesn't look. They all leave. He's like, hey, I'm an MYOB in this situation. 2 days later, the police, they begin a more thorough investigation. They just had to take a breather and think things through, really take some time for themselves. So they start looking at all the clothing, and they inspect the hatchets, and they tell Lizzie she is now officially a suspect. And at some point after this, Alice comes back over to the house, and she finds Lizzie, and Lizzie is in the backyard burning a dress. And cool. when she... Right?
Yeah.
So she asks Lizzie, what's going on? And Lizzie says, oh, I got some paint on this dress, so I can't wear it anymore.
So I'm just going to be cool about it and burn
I'm
it
I'm just going to burn it. Stare.
I'm Chloe Sevigny.
So Alice gets the creeps and leaves. So on August 8th, they take Lizzie in. The police take Lizzie in for questioning. I don't know. They could have come to her house. I'm not sure if they had a police station or what the setup was.
They go somewhere.
They take her in conceptually. I don't know where. she asks for an attorney. They refuse. Mm. I guess they could do that back then. All the rules were different. It was totally opposite year. and at one point, she freaks out so bad that they have to give her a shot of morphine.
Fun.
So as you would imagine, that affects her testimony when they begin to question her. She can't really track what she's saying, mm-hmm. and she's contradicting herself, and she's a little erratic, maybe kind of sleepy. she says she was on the stairs, then she says she never went up the stairs. She says she took her father's boots off. They show her the crime scene photo where his boots are on. Eventually, the investigators discover that the day before the murders, Lizzie had tried to buy something called prussic acid, otherwise known as cyanide, at the drugstore in town. But the clerk told her that she needed a prescription for it.
My doctor says I need this.
Oh, my bones. It was either back then, it was either if you had an illness or an ailment of any kind, you either got cyanide or cocaine. Those were your two choices.
Sometimes you'd get them together and have a fucking party.
Speedball. Okay. So there's a trial. On August 11th, a warrant is served. Lizzie's arrested for the murder of her parents. 5 days before the trial begins, I find this to be so fascinating. I didn't know this before. 5 days before the trial begins, there's another axe murder in the area.
What?
Yes. And that suspect goes to trial and is convicted, but the police say that the man was not in the Falls River area at the time of the Borden double murder. Did I say Falls? Fall. Sorry. It's very late. So they say he's not around. But I just think that's the most... What is bizarre coincidence?
Copycat.
Man. Yeah.
No.
And then, I don't know. Okay, so Lizzie Borden's trial begins June of 1893. Of course, it's a media sensation. They compare it now to, like, it was like the OJ trial of the day. It's all anybody talked about. There were reporters in this tiny town from New York, from Boston. All these people packing the courtroom. And... So the prosecution just brings the facts. Here's the broken hatchet head that was found in the basement. Alice Russell gets up, testifies about Lizzie burning the dress. All the places Lizzie says she was are brought up, all her conflicting stories. But Lizzie maintains that she was in the barn at the time of the attacks. A witness named Hyman Lubinsky, he says... I mean, what can we do? It was the past. He says he saw Lizzie leave the barn at 11:03 a.m. And Charles the gardener confirms it. I guess he doesn't have a last name. At 11:10, Lizzie called to Maggie downstairs or upstairs saying that her father had been killed. So they're trying to put the timeline together of where she actually was. And there was a lot of dramatics in the courtroom, of course. And at one point, when it is revealed that Abby and Andrew's heads were removed for the autopsy, Lizzie faints dead away in the courtroom.
Shit.
Altogether, the trial lasts 2 weeks, which is actually really short. And then when the jury goes out, they're only out for 1.5 hours, and then they come back with the verdict, and they find Lizzie Borden not guilty.
What?
She's acquitted of this crime. It seems like a lot of people don't know that. But the jury found her not guilty. So when she was leaving the courthouse, she told the press, I am the happiest woman in the... No, she told them, I'm the happiest woman in the world.
Can't you tell? I'm smiling.
Now, what's crazy is, because of the wonderful children's rhyme that we all learned and the legend, Lizzie remained the prime suspect in everyone's mind, basically to this day. And she's been memorialized basically as an axe murderer. And why do people believe so strongly that she did it? There's lots of theories, and there was lots of kind of good reasoning. First of all, it's all the personal elements of the murders that you know, a hatchet to the face, to the head. It's obviously somebody that had a lot of rage and wanted revenge, or, you know, the attack was personal, theorizing. So obviously she could have done it for the money. She had a lot. She stood to inherit a ton of money from her father. And clearly, if he was like parsing out the millions to his new wife, mm-hmm. then that meant her inheritance was getting smaller. Mm-hmm. There was also a theory she was being physically and sexually abused by her father, which would then track with the viciousness of the attack. There was also a rumor that Lizzie was having a tryst with Maggie, the Irish maid.
Ooh.
And that's right. And then, and because of that, Andrew and Abby, or one or the other, were witness to that, and they had to get rid of the witnesses. But none of those are proven to be true. That's just all theory and or gossip around the town. So the Borden sisters get their inheritance because Lizzie's acquitted. And after the trial, they buy a huge modern house in the Hill neighborhood of Fall River.
And they name it Fuck You, Dad. Jesus.
Fuck You, Dad Manor. Yeah. They hire a full staff.
Wow.
They just like live large up in their manor house. Lizzie begins calling herself Lizbeth. Mm. Like a college sophomore that goes to France for one semester. But everyone's in town's like, you're fucking Lizzie Borden and you killed your father with 40 whacks of an axe, so get the fuck out of here.
Oh my God.
So she is ostracized by society. Mm-hmm. And then in 1905, her and her sister Emma get into a fight, and Emma moves out of their mansion on the hill, and the sisters never see each other again.
Aww.
Yeah. So Lizzie Borden died of pneumonia on June 1st, 1927, at the age of 74, and only a couple people attended her funeral.
Wow.
Her sister Emma died 9 days later.
Aww.
Yeah, isn't that sad? They're buried next to each other now in Oak Grove Cemetery, and that is the legend of Lizzie Borden.
Damn!
Damn! For more accurate information, you can also watch the Christina Ricci series that was on. That's pretty good. Christina Ricci has a really creepy, like, stare and forehead as well. She works that. She can work that costume.
Sure, that part down the middle bang.
That's someone who can work the part down the middle.
That's right. Okay, that was incredible. Great job.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much.
Do you not think she did it?
Like, I kind of don't care, but I like the rhyme. I think it would make sense. It seems like it was such an oppressive household. Mm-hmm. Like, to have a father that has millions of dollars and won't get fucking electricity.
Yeah.
Like, just as someone who's... My father would not buy us Atari when we were growing up, and we weren't poor. He just wouldn't do it, like, on principle. And then finally, one Christmas, he got us a used Pong, like, machine.
Which isn't Atari, kids.
No. Pong is like caveman Atari.
Yeah.
Pong is just tennis. It's lines. It's like two L's playing a game against
Dung.
Each other.
Dung.
It was so long Dung. After...
That one, right?
Yeah.
Dung.
Yeah. And we were just like, what? Why? Like, what did we ever do to you?
Yeah. So imagine electricity.
Imagine. Now, knowing how mad I was about the Pong... This seems like it's very, very possible. And also just there's things about it, like the fact that everybody got sick. I think maybe she was trying out a couple things, and maybe that fight, and there was just things building. I also think back then, women just didn't, it was like she didn't get married. You know, she was a Sunday school teacher. Just all of her life was really oppressive, obviously very dedicated to the family. So it's just like she went off. Yeah. And she just snapped, it seems like.
Shit.
Maybe. Or maybe she's just a victim because she just doesn't react to anything. And people hate that.
Yeah. Well, and that's our take. That's the part of the podcast called, and that's our take.
Our take is, we don't know. Our take is, I'm sure someone wrote a great book that's going to explain exactly why it's one way or the other, but I didn't read it.
This is, I'm going to do the Eastern Airlines hijacking of Flight 1320.
Whoa.
You know I love a fucking crazy-ass hijacking
Hell
story.
Hell yes.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, clear it.
Here we go.
Warm up that instrument.
So let me just give you some an overview.
Please do.
A history. When the government started to oversee aviation in 1958, hijacking wasn't a crime yet, and the early airports were designed in a way that made it so you could just go on in and bring whatever you want on board. You just walked right through onto the tarmac, get on the plane, you didn't even fucking buy a ticket.
You didn't have to put your cigarette out.
No. They were like, please smoke on the plane, it helps it rise up in the air.
Wait, what do you mean you didn't buy a ticket?
You get on the, it's like a train. You get on the plane, and then they're like, tickets, tickets,
no.
and you pay for your ticket from your fucking seat, I swear. I swear I read this. I don't know if...
It's true on the internet.
It's true on the internet. Isn't that insane?
Yeah, that's so crazy.
So the stewardess, they were called at the time, which is a fucking outdated term, we all know.
Good catch.
So you would just go and they'd give you a ticket, no ID, nothing like that. You just paid for your ticket and they were like, great. And hijacking wasn't considered a serious threat by the airlines or the passengers. So it started happening and it was almost like a prank. Like it was basically like when the dude who would like, the streaker who would run on the fucking field, it was like, that guy, you're slowing the game down.
Stop it.
But you're funny. Like,
stop it.
So it would just be people who wanted to go places and they would hijack the plane and just be like, take me to Cuba was a normal thing. And they would take them there and everything would be fine. Like,
so, to or from?
To.
Really?
Where from?
Okay,
wherever.
Right.
I don't know, anywhere. It was kind of seen as an inconvenience more than anything else. They would be like, oh, great, we're going to Cuba.
Okay. Honey, we got hijacked. I'm going to be like 3 hours late.
Exactly. And there was actually an Italian-American dude who hijacked a plane from Los Angeles. He made them take him to Rome. When he arrived, he was hailed as a hero by all the Italians. They refused to extradite him.
Yes.
Because they were like, this fucking guy. And he was also incredibly hot, so they fucking cast him in a spaghetti western.
Yes.
Like, that's how hijacking was.
Yes.
Yeah. So it wasn't, no one gave a shit.
What movie? Is that Clint Eastwood?
Probably.
Is that how Clint Eastwood got his start?
There's a 99% Invisible podcast episode about hijacking that talks about this stuff.
Okay.
Eventually, the hijackers start to become more like classic kidnappers demanding ransom. So they were like, we better do something about this. So in 1968, the FAA created an anti-hijacking task force to come up with solutions because the airlines were like, we don't want to spend all this money. It's going to cost so much money to check people and make sure they're hijackers or not. So let's all think of a better solution. And they were like, hey, the public, feel free to fucking throw in your suggestions as well.
Oh, really?
They were like, we want to hear it.
So they took calls?
They took calls. They came up with shit like, what if we do a fake airport that we pretend is Cuba, but it's really here in Florida, and then we arrest them when they get off. And they're like, too expensive.
Perfect.
Then someone was like, how about an ejector seat for the hijackers?
Yes.
Not fucking kidding. Or a seat where like you get a shot of like morphine comes up and shoots the hijacker with sleeping pills and shit.
These were all the ideas from a fifth grade classroom.
That's right.
Spider-Man.
How about Spider-Man comes in? Okay, so then none of those worked.
Yeah, they didn't.
Uh-huh. So one flight was hijacked in 1969, and this is how little people, how not seriously people took it. In 1969, it was hijacked from Newark to Miami. And this is, there's an episode of Radiolab that talks about this. The host of the show Candid Camera, you guys know that popular show, yeah. Alan Funt was on board with his family. The plane gets legit hijacked. And when the passengers see Alan Funt, they're like, oh, you can't get us. And they're like, this is a prank show. And even when the hijackers come out of the cockpit, they all applaud him for being an actor. They're like, you can't. And Alan Funt's like, I swear to fucking God, this is not a prank. He's the only, like, him and his wife and kid are the only ones who know it's not a prank.
Actually,
the hijackers.
That's, okay, first of all, how fucking hilariously frustrating for those hijackers where they're like, yeah. You'll get everybody get down. And they're like, fuck you.
You can't fool me, Alan.
I recognize you.
It's a great episode of Radio called Smile My Ass. It's really funny.
That's so good.
That's right. And so it wasn't until the plane actually landed in Havana instead of Florida, and the fucking plane is surrounded by Cuban military officers, that people finally believed it was. Which is like, if something like that is happening, I want to believe it's a joke until it's not anymore.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, what a great way.
Yes. Like, you mean like when we were flying here today and the plane just went like this, real quick, it went.
And yep. I was fucking studying this happened. I couldn't tell you that. I couldn't let you know. I was like, yeah, it was scary because I'm studying hijacking right now.
Oh, that's all. It was scary, but it was scary in that way where I went, like, everybody went like that. But then it was just completely normal as if it didn't happen. And then I was just like, please don't have a panic attack. I was like begging my brain, like, just stay in this mode right now and don't think about how that felt.
Well, it was what I do every time, and I'm sure everyone else does, is look at the flight attendant. Is she cool? She's cool.
She's cool.
Okay, then everything, if she's going like this, then I'm like gonna have a panic attack. If she's still getting like cups and
stuff.
Yeah,
she did not miss a beat.
No.
She was just like, whatever.
Yeah, get these assholes out up here. So this is what hijackings were like and that's how things stood on March 17th, 1970, St. Patrick's Day, your favorite holiday, everyone here, Boston. So that's when, March 17th, 1970, when the first death caused by air piracy in U.S. history took place in Massachusetts airspace.
Wow.
Yeah. So here we are. Okay. So 7:30 p.m., Eastern Airlines flight bound for Boston from Newark, New Jersey, takes off with 68 passengers.
Newark.
I have to burp. Excuse me. Shit. Edit that out of your brains, please. So it's 68 passengers and 5 crew members are aboard. Everything is totally normal until shortly after takeoff, they're passing over Franklin, and when about 30 miles south of Logan Airport, when the flight attendant comes around to collect the ticket money. You want to buy a ticket for this plane you're already on?
Yeah, exactly. What happens when you're like, I don't have any money?
Well,
then you better go smoke in the bathroom, I guess.
She gets to a man named John J. DeVivo. He tells the flight attendant that he doesn't have any money for the $15.75 ticket.
Wow. How long ago? In 70?
I don't have today's money, how much that is, but I'm sure it's not the $700 it would cost today.
That's what I was going to say.
Huh?
I started saying $700.
Oh, my God.
Hi.
Hey. He says, I don't have the money, and asks to speak to the pilot, and then pulls out a .38 caliber revolver.
Dang.
So John DeVivo is a 27-year-old who lived with his family in New Jersey. When he was 16 years old, 11 years before, he had shot himself in the head in a suicide attempt. He survived, but the bullet remained lodged in his skull, and as a result, his behavior had become more and more erratic over time.
I bet.
What fucking happens. Eventually, leading up to this hijacking 11 years later, and he boarded the plane wearing a chain necklace with a skull and bones amulet on it.
Cool.
Which I'm sure half the people here are wearing. But back then, it was fucking weird. the flight attendant brings this guy, John DeVivo, to the cockpit, which was being manned by Captain John Robert Wilbur Jr. He's 35 years old. He's an Air Force pilot who had only been promoted to captain 6 months prior.
Hey.
And he is with his co-pilot, First Officer James Hartley, who's 30. The Captain Wilbur calmly says to the flight attendant, okay, please let all the passengers know everything is fine and nothing is wrong. Put on your flight attendant face.
Yes.
And so she goes back, and then the captain and his co-pilot, they expect DeVivo to demand to be taken to Cuba, because that was like where everyone wanted to go at the time when they hijacked a plane. But instead, DeVivo tells the captain to fly east until they run out of gas.
Yeah. That's a bad fucking plan.
No, it's bad. After, they were like, great, we'll do it. But after about 15 minutes, the captain said, told him that they'd crash into the Atlantic if they didn't return to Boston for fuel. So, because they had been on their final approach for landing at the moment, so they didn't have a lot of gas, fuel, gas.
I'm sure it's just unleaded.
Right?
Yeah.
So DeVivo, he says okay to the refueling trip, but as soon as the plane starts to turn, he gets spooked somehow, and he abruptly shoots Officer Hartley in the chest.
Oh, shit.
And shoots Captain Wilbur twice, one in each arm. I know.
No.
It's bananas.
Those are his steering arms.
I know.
Crucial to flying a plane.
That's right. Officer Hartley collapses, but despite being, he's the one who got shot in the chest, despite being mortally wounded, he fucking recovers enough to rip the gun from DeVivo's hand, fucking shoots him 3 times.
Sorry, this is a lot of gunfire for a plane that's still in the air.
And then he lapses into unconsciousness and dies.
Oh, shit.
What? How have we never heard about this?
I mean, what a way to go out, too. You're
Dude.
Just like, fuck you.
He fucking, yes. He, DeVivo is wounded. He slumps between the seats, but he's able to fucking, this is like a magic plane. He's able to fucking revive himself. He doesn't have his gun anymore, but he starts clawing at Captain Wilbur, attempting to grab the fucking steering wheel and force it to crash.
Mm.
Fucking, this, okay. Cut. Let's take a break for a second.
Yes, please.
Whew. Deep breath, everyone. Meanwhile.
Does anyone want a snack?
A cigarette? How about a cigarette?
Snacks? Snacks.
Oh, yes. Meanwhile, back in the plane, this passenger, Peggy McLaughlin, she's a 19-year-old Boston College student at the time.
Yeah. So she's not fucking around.
Uh-uh. She says that they were only dimly aware of the life or death battle going on in the cabin, that the passengers didn't even know what was going on. They heard a commotion. Someone said it sounded like a fake gun. Pop gun? Sure. Cap gun.
Thank you.
They didn't know what was going on. And didn't realize they were in the midst of attempted hijacking until the shots rang out. And that when they heard that, some people dove from their seats to the floor, and that they realized the flight had veered off course because they found themselves flying over the Back Bay. Peggy thought they were going to land in the harbor, so she fucking starts taking her boots off, like ready to fucking swim.
Always ready, that Peggy.
That's right. And you know there's probably some hot, like sexy 1970s boots,
That's
too.
That's right. And then she's like, I might as well change into my suit while we're doing this.
It's basically, yeah. So meanwhile, let's go back to the cockpit. So Wilbur, Captain Wilbur, he's fighting with fucking DeVivo. He grabs the gun that had fallen to the ground, hits DeVivo over the fucking head with it, subduing him, beats him with the pistol while continuing to fly the fucking plane.
And those are bullet arms,
those
right?
Those are fucking, both of his arms are shot. Then Captain Wilbur radios the tower and says, my co-pilot is shot. Where the hell do you want me to put this thing?
So hot.
So hot, so hard. He doesn't even mention that he's shot at all. So now DeVivo is unconscious, and despite being shot in both fucking arms, bleeding badly, Captain Wilbur is able to right the plane, because it had plunged during the struggle.
Ugh.
Yeah, and then safely lands safely and smoothly lands the fucking aircraft.
They can't do that sometimes when we're just coming into LAX.
Yeah, and everything is fine.
Yeah.
Smoothly at Logan. He yes. fucking lands that thing.
Yes, he does.
Bananas. The entire event took place in only 10 to 15 miles away from Logan International Airport at an altitude of between 3 and 5,000 feet. That's
Whoa.
Nothing.
No, it is not.
Right? Once the plane safely on the ground, Aviva was arrested and charged with murder. He's sent to Bridgewater State Hospital for a mental evaluation.
You can cheer for Bridgewater State Hospital.
We have a whole group from there tonight.
Yes,
right?
Great. Welcome.
He's taken for a mental evaluation, but basically they're like, fuck this shit, and he's taken to Suffolk County Jail at Charles Street. And no trial would take place, though, because on Halloween 1970, while awaiting trial for air piracy and murder, DeVivo hangs himself in his cell.
Mm.
Peggy McLaughlin, our 19-year-old booted girl.
Please tell me she marries the captain.
Oh, no, that would be so cute.
Dang it.
Oh, shit.
We'll make it that way in the movie.
Yeah. She's played by Chloe Sevigny.
Yay.
She becomes a librarian and a yoga instructor. Amazing. And she doesn't fucking talk about this for decades. Like, it was a time period where they were like, you good? Great. You don't need therapy. The end.
Goodbye.
That's it. Yeah. Don't talk about it ever again.
Best if you don't tell anyone.
Right.
Yeah.
She said one time the FBI stopped by after to ask her questions about it, and then she never fucking spoke about it again until when Captain Sully landed it turned into a boat.
Yeah.
But at first it was a plane and landed in the Hudson, and then she's like, you know what? I have a story to fucking tell, too.
Oh, you like landing planes in an emergency?
Water?
I got a story.
Great. But she says that the memory had never left her, of course. Yeah. So James Hartley and Captain Wilbur were proclaimed heroes. And on March 24th, 1970, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution that commended them both for their, quote, extraordinary heroism and competence. Now retired Captain Robert Wilbur, the captain... says the captain. Captain Robert, or the captain, I wrote. He says he doesn't think about it that often. But Peggy eventually wrote a letter to him thanking him for saving her life.
And then they fell in love?
No.
Oh.
Captain Wilbur insisted that he was just doing his job and that James Hartley was the hero.
Oh.
And that, you guys, is the Eastern Airlines hijacking of Flight 1320.
Oh. That was amazing.
How crazy is that?
It was amazing. It's like, isn't that long? I just hate when I find out how many things I don't know.
I know.
There's just so many things in that story where I'm like, wait, what? What?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Like a train, you just get on and then you pay while you're on the plane.
So stupid.
1570.
There was on a plane, the plane that we flew out here on, I went into the bathroom and they had an ashtray in the door.
It's so scary when that happens.
It's so scary. You're like, how fucking old is
this
plane?
It happens. We go on a lot of planes and the majority of them still have ashtrays.
Yeah.
And that, we're here tonight to petition.
We need to start cycling those fucking things out.
For that to stop. Or let's just start smoking on planes again. But I don't want to, yeah. It's terrifying.
It's insane.
Do we have time for our home
time? I think we do, actually.
Thank you. Let me pick my various undergarments out of the places they're not supposed to be.
Standing up. All right.
Karen has some rules.
I have some things. And I think it's really important that you listen to me right now. Because there are people, I say this part, and people do not listen. They don't. And then they get picked. And then they do a thing that I ask them not to do. And everyone in the room doesn't like them because of that. And it's not good. So listen to what I'm telling you right now. When we do hometown murders and we're in the city, we like it when it's a local story. So
the state is fine.
The state is good. Local's good. We love accents. we want to hear something from what happened around here. That'd be great. Also, of course, I think you guys know this, it's good if you're not so drunk you can't follow your own line of logic.
Those are like the top two rules.
It's pretty important. It's very nerve-wracking to be up here. Once you get up here, there's like a, you think you're fine at first, then this wave hits you, then your mind goes blank. You start remembering weird shit you did in high school. There's a whole experience to it, so you might think you have it in the pocket. Just make sure. It's good when your story has a beginning, a middle, and an end, for sure. Usually it's good when the end pays off. So like our last hometown was amazing because it had this awesome ending. Mm-hmm. So that's, I always recommend that. And then finally, it's, just remember everyone in the room hates you because you got picked. So make it quick. All right. And now George is going to pick.
Me or you? I think you.
Do you want me to do it?
I want Karen to do it. Because you guys get this face, and it hurts me in my soul, and she can't see anything.
You know why? Because you do it, you look at them too much.
I know.
It's more of a psychic, it's an Italian psychic grandmother thing.
Show me how it's done.
You have to do.
Show me how it's done.
Could you bring the lights up a little bit, if it's possible? We'll just look at them. You can't do it, rich bitches in the balcony. You crazy? Fucking fools. Yeah. Come on. Is it this way?
Oh, yeah. Vince is right there.
Yeah, walk over here. I mean, I like your spirit and everything. It's nice. Did you think you were just going to jump down?
The thing is, we called the balcony rich at the last show. So you just called the rich bitch.
Hi. What's your name?
It's Vince. Thank you.
Tabby. Come on.
Hi, come here. What's your name? Tabby. Hi, Tabby. Here's a microphone.
This is Tabby, everybody.
Hi, Tabby.
Hi. Oh.
Look at all your flair.
Bob's Burgers.
Yay. And then,
yeah. My favorite murder.
Oh, that's us. That's us.
That's my podcast.
That's us. Yeah. Where are you from?
New Bedford.
Okay. Is that here?
Nice. Check.
Check.
Okay, so... this is like still an ongoing thing that's going on.
Uh-oh.
But this is the murder of
shit.
And she was the first person that was murdered this year in New Bedford.
Wow.
Yeah. The case is still going, but on January 22nd, around 2 a.m., she was found outside of her home. Screaming. She wasn't dead yet. Sorry. And
we're not laughing about that part.
Yeah,
it's
no.
More nervousness yeah. and stuff like that.
She was stabbed multiple times. It actually ended up being over 49 times.
Oh, God.
By her neighbor. Because her neighbor didn't like how loud she played her music or her dog. She had like a emotional support dog that was like small and yappy named Lolita.
Mm-hmm.
And aww. It was too loud, so he decided to stab her.
Jesus.
Yeah, super bad. and they texted each other like days before, and they actually like use the texts as evidence and stuff. And they talked about how like they were gonna beat her up and sick his like pit bulls apparently on her.
Oh.
But both her and her dog were stabbed, and she unfortunately did not make it, but her dog did survive.
Okay.
So Valia lived.
Yeah. Tabby, everybody.
Yay.
Great job.
That way. Thank you.
Oh my God, you guys. These two shows have been unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I truly think this has been the least drunk, yelly crowd, the two of them, we've ever had.
Incredible. Well, like, you know what it is? It feels like everyone's listening intently,
yeah.
like just right there listening. It's such a great feeling. It's not like you guys have a bad reputation or anything like that.
We did ply Brooklyn last night with canned wine, so that might have been our own fault. But you guys, these two shows have been so much fun. And the fact that we sold out three fucking shows.
Three shows.
Thank you so, so much for supporting us. We're so freaking lucky to be here and to be part of this.
We're very, every time the ticket sales start and then people start tweeting us with insanely angry messages about how they didn't get tickets and what we need to do about it, we really take it as a huge compliment.
Yeah,
because
it warms our heart.
This is a very, this thing that's happening with this podcast is just very rare and it's very, very special. You guys have started your own community. You're connecting with each other. It's just, it's incredible. And we're really honored to be doing this with you. It's, you know, it's really a beautiful thing to see. And we really, really appreciate it. We hope you know that we are so, so grateful that we get to be here with you.
It's insane.
We really are.
Thank you.
Yes. So, Boston, stay sexy.
And
good night, you guys.